Hi, everybody. I'm Scott.
Hello, I'm Julie.
And this is a Good Story is Hard to Find podcast,
where two Catholic friends talk about the books and movies they love and the traces of the one reality that lie below the surface.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this week we're going to talk about St. Peter. The book is called St. Peter, Flawed, Forgiven, and Faithful by Stephen Binz, B-I-N-Z. There's a J in there, I think, isn't there? I think he uses a J.
To differentiate him from all the other Stephen Binzes.
Maybe there are more. Yeah.
So many. But also my book has like another, like a subhead up above the thumb of St. Peter's hand with keys. And it says, Walking with Peter from Galilee to Rome.
Oh, nice. Okay.
And that's good. One of the things that struck me when I was reading the book, and this was my second time to read it. I remember feeling such a sense of place when I read this book, and it reminded me of Father James Martin's book,
Jesus, a
Thank
Pilgrimage.
You.
Yeah,
of course. Which
I was
talked
thinking
about.
The exact same thing. So
okay, yeah. There you go.
Yeah, yeah. In that book, I think Father Martin used his travels, this trip that he was doing, to illustrate different parts of Jesus's life. So it sort of bounced between, you know, let's talk about Jesus's life and what am I experiencing today as a traveler?
Right.
And that was a similarity here.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I loved it. This is a great book. I love it. And he wrote another one that I like. And I wish I had it here in front of me. But it's also St. Peter with a subtitle. But it has something to do with it's a scriptural study. And he basically takes all of the scriptures which he did here too, but he takes the scriptures where Peter makes an appearance and talks about every one of them.
Well, and that's kind of Stephen Binz's specialty. And I got lucky enough at one point when blogs were more influential and I wound up having various short email conversations with him because he'd have a new book coming out
and
he would ask me to review it. Yeah. And he did a lot of things that revolved around taking a topic, following it scripturally, and looking at it as kind of as they would say, Lectio Divina, which is a holy reading, meaning you read it with God, kind of like over your shoulder.
Yeah.
And then you kind of think about it. And it opens up, you know, your prayer life. It opens up what you're reading. And he had one that I really like. I was looking. I don't see any other titles he's done listed here, but about feast days and festivals of the Catholic
that's
Church.
Cool.
Or of the Jewish faith and how they then translate into the Catholic Church.
Hmm.
That I really liked that was like that.
Oh, that's great. Yeah.
Yeah, he's really
like
good at those.
That, yeah.
Okay. Well,
so I looked up the name of the book I was talking about, and it's called Peter, Fisherman and Shepherd of the Church. And then in parentheses, it says ancient-future Bible study. So it's some special technique, I guess, of Bible study that he's following. But that's what they call it. It may be a series. I'm not all written by him, but he may have written a book in a series here.
Yeah,
But anyway, I liked it very much. That was my first one I read by him.
Yeah.
So
he's good. He's solid.
Yeah. So it's really cool to read this stuff. I mean, I'm drawn to Peter because, you know, it says right in the title that he's flawed. And I am also, so it's really nice to have someone who made it. Way to go, Peter. Way to go.
Don't we all
he made it.
Love Peter? I mean, and you and I were talking about this before the podcast, but I was like, you know, here's the thing. It's not like he makes the same mistake just once. And gets over it.
Yeah.
Peter's always out there going, no, Lord, let me tell you how it's going to work. Oh, no, don't wash just my feet. Do all of me. I mean, all the things. Oh, no, I'll never, you know, betray you.
Oh, man, yeah.
I was like, oh, man, not even a few hours is going to go by, you know. And that's me. I am just blah, blah, blah out there.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like I relate to Peter because I'm sure he was like, I can't believe I did that. Will I ever learn?
Oh, yeah.
So he gives me hope.
Yes, he gives me hope as well.
Because he keeps plugging and doing his best.
Right. Jesus works with what he has, right?
Yeah.
And that's really good. Yeah, because, I mean, there is nobody perfect among us, so he would have to, but, you know.
Well, and Jesus looks at us and sees the potential, and he knows what we were kind of created for, the spot we were created for. And I'm not talking about predestination, but just, you know, in God's view of history, as we've discussed before, we are put into history in our time for a reason.
Hmm.
With the kind of personalities we have. And what we do with all that is up to us and our cooperation with God. And St. Peter's the same way.
Yeah.
You know, and I loved the things that Stephen J. Binns would point out here, where he'd go, you know, we think about him and we go, a simple, or maybe, oh gosh, now I'm reading the other book too. Crap. Okay, so you might have to cut this out in case I'm fixing the other book, where it's like he's not just a simple fisherman, you also had to be a businessman.
Yeah.
Fishing was a big industry.
Oh.
And he was running a crew.
Yeah, right, right. Had his own boat.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it makes it sound like, you know, when we just look at the scripture and we think about it from our point of view as urban Americans, we go, oh, simple fellow. You know, he had to be brought along a long way. Well, you know, but he, as the person he was, he had to be confident.
Yeah.
He had to be able to see things, grasp them, see how they fit into a picture. I mean, you know, it's not like he was a consummate businessman all round. And he had to stop and learn all the things that Jesus was teaching him. But Jesus knew who he was.
Mm.
He knew he's somebody who could lead people.
Yeah.
Who could listen to what God was telling him and use that and go forward with it.
I do like that. One of the things that struck me in reading this the second time is I highlighted a quote where it just, I really hadn't thought of the aspect of the fisherman, right? And Stephen Ben says, it seems that the characteristics of good fishermen are also some of the important qualities of good disciples. The patience and perseverance required for fishing must mark the life of disciples because of the frequent discouragement and hardship they encounter. And I hadn't really thought of that before, you know. And if anything, you know, a Dallas Cowboy fan would be a great disciple.
Oh,
because of the patience and perseverance it requires.
We get it, man.
And the frequent discouragement. But I just hadn't thought about that. And that's one of the things, you know, I got this out of James Martin's book, too, is when you just read it, you know, and you're thinking about Christ as a human being and walking around, and you're like walking around where he walked around and just looking at what's there. And, you know, just, you know, so the fact that he was a fisherman, like you were saying, I mean, there are other aspects of it too. But that was just an interesting little sense that he has there. Because, yeah, I mean, patience, perseverance, frequent disappointment. Yeah, this is fishing. So, yeah, he'd go out there all day and come back with nothing. And that story's even in the Bible, right?
And, yeah, although I would feel like, sometimes that's going to happen because when you're working with nature. But I feel like if you're a good fisherman, you know where to look.
Yes.
You know what to predict.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why the couple of times when Jesus gives him the overwhelming fish that, you know, are breaking the nets and everything, he suddenly reacts in a way he hasn't before because he knows exactly what that means because it's speaking his language.
Mm-hmm.
Comes together in a way that just turns everything on. And that's the same thing that happens at the end of the book when Jesus is resurrected and he's on the beach and they've been fishing and not catching anything too there.
Hmm.
Right?
Yep, right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, you know, all the fish.
Yeah.
Throw your nets in one more time.
Yeah, and he says, yeah, throw that in one more time. And he's like, I know who you are.
Well, yeah. The beloved disciple does. And then he goes, what? You're right. Let's go.
I've heard this before. I love it.
Yeah.
Oh, but it's terrific. And I liked, you know, what he had to say as a traveler, too. I haven't traveled to the Holy Land, but I would like to, and it's fun. It would be fun to do that. It would be really kind of a great thing, I imagine. But he talks about, oh, I always like to go here first because then we can kind of follow this and go here. You know, I thought those details were kind of neat.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, thinking about the logic of following that path.
Yeah, and it's a good reminder, too, that, you know, here we have this Bible, we have Old and New Testament, and these places exist. You know, yes. It's not like, you know, this is Narnia or, you know, some place that we don't know where it is. I mean, we don't know where Eden is, I guess, or where Eden was, you know, but everything else is there. I mean, they're still finding things. But that's a remarkable thing about the Bible, in my opinion. And that may be because, you know, I am here in Utah and we have the Book of Mormon in the Mormon religion. And none of those places are there. I mean, you may get an argument from Mormons, you know, that would connect places to other places. But, you know, there's no, it's the names aren't the same or anything like that. You know, it's kind of a stretch, the archaeology.
Yeah, but you can't just pick up a map and look at the historical record that traces back through, oh, it's had five names, and here's exactly. Back to the name you were talking about.
That's exactly right. And even in, right. You know, when we talk about Peter, one of the things that I was wondering is, you know, so near the end, I mean, I don't know how we'll go through this, but just talking about like when Peter and Paul were together in Rome at the end of their lives, and then they were both executed. And, you know, Paul was executed by beheading because he was Roman and he got to have the good version, I guess.
Yes.
And then Peter, not being a Roman, you know, crucified upside down on Vatican Hill. And that's an incredible thing. But, you know, all of that is just there. And the reason I brought that up is because I was just curious. It's like, well, where else do we have this information? Is there a record or anything like that? And a lot of other people wrote about it that, you know, were historians and things that are not in the Bible.
Time.
Yeah. And maybe a little after the time, too. But you know, it's interesting, you know. So there's this... You know, I got to go to Rome with my dad. I told you that. It was like in 2020. Mm. And one of the things we did is we were in a tour group with the Archbishop of Miami. It was ad limina visit that they were doing. And it was awesome.
What a deal.
It was quite a deal. But the one of the things that dad and I did on a day where we had some free time is we went to the Mamertine prison, which it talks, Stephen Binns talks about that. So I stood alone in the cell where Peter was supposed to have been.
Oh, that's cool.
I was there. I was like, I need some time right here. But it's amazing. So, but there's this saying there in Rome. It's as if they were quoting something where it says, Paul was taken to the left and Peter was taken to the right. And I was wondering, well, where does that come from? I mean, it's not in the Bible, but what, you know, where did it come from? And it's Christian tradition, I guess.
Okay.
That's so, what but I thought. There's not like a written thing, but there is an Acts of Peter and an Acts of Paul that are both apocryphal, and they both mention the execution methods, but neither of them say right and left. But
it's poetic.
Right. Exactly. So, again, it's just amazing that everything's just there, and I mean, that says a lot. That says a lot to me. I mean, these aren't places that don't exist. And even in the Old Testament.
Yeah, it's historical.
Right.
And the thing I like, and this book emphasizes it, as I mentioned before, but is that these places are real and you can go there, as you say. But also, they were being used by Jesus to make points that were emphasized in the listeners' minds. So when he's out on the ocean and they're in an area where people are plowing and he's in the boat and he's talking to everybody about, you know, the sowers and the good soil and the bad soil and all this, there are people who would have been sowing right around there. It's like he was looking and going, well, for example, you know,
yeah,
it's not like he went, oh, I'm gonna tell him this great story about sowing. He looks, and of course, because he is who he is, he says, oh, well, this is perfect. Here we go. And everybody can look at it and think about it. It will be imprinted in their minds every time the idea comes up. And one of the things I especially loved, and I remember this from the first time I read the book, was when, and this is one of the most contested passages by Protestants who don't like to think that Simon was renamed as Peter and he was going to be on this rock, I'll build my church, says Jesus. And so they don't like to think about the idea of the Pope
being Peter. Yeah.
Because they've rejected the idea, they've protested the idea of a Pope. And so they say that when they go to Caesarea Philippi, that's where Jesus took Peter and everybody to do that. And he points out, he says, there's this huge rock that everybody would have known about. And the rock has a cave in it. And the cave would have been thought of as a gate to the underworld. So this would have been the gate of Hades, which is to say hell. So again, the gates of hell shall not prevail against you. And also, they thought of it as the way for the fertility gods to go back and forth. And that would have been the Greek god Pan. So there was a temple there for Pan. So in this place is where Jesus first says he's going to establish a church. It's going to be built on Peter the Rock. The gates of Hades can't prevail against it. And so basically, Jesus is saying, I'm going to set right all these things that have been misunderstood and misinterpreted. And all the wrong ideas. I'm going to take, as Tolkien would have told to C.S. Lewis, the myths that are just the stories, and I'm going to make them into the real myth or story. Now I'm going to show what they really mean. And it happened in that real place because this is illustrating all these things.
Yeah, that's incredible. Incredible. And he also, Benz also pointed out that that was a pagan area, right?
Right, so the again, whole thing is pagan, that's why. Also stressed
that the Gospels are going to be for everybody, or the this is for everyone, this, you know, this saving that he's doing, right?
Right, yeah.
The stuff I'm doing is for everybody. It's not just for Jewish people.
Yeah, he wasn't at the temple in Jerusalem when he did this.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And that's a striking thing, too, So, but yeah, just those surroundings. You know, one of the stories about Jesus' life, where he goes out in a boat so that people can hear him speak. There's so many people on the shore that he gets on a boat and goes out just a little ways and then starts to talk. And this is not the first time I've heard it, but Ben's talked about the natural amphitheater that is created by where he was, and how water carries the voice. And everything like that. You know, I just love those details. It's like you go there and you see and you're like, oh, wow, I can see this now. You know, I can see why it's here. But but the rock and everything, that was great, great stuff.
Mm-hmm. And I guess that's why they say, well, for more than one reason, but the Holy Land is often called the fifth gospel. Because you go and you're standing in all those places where those things really happened. And suddenly it's come alive. It's preaching to you in a different way, the way that nature does or something like that, you know?
Yeah. It'd be amazing to go on a trip with this guy. I wonder if he's still doing them. It sounds like he just does them fairly often. It sounded like.
Well, yeah, maybe once the war is over.
Yeah. Yeah. There is that.
Yeah. I know. Yeah. I thought about that the other day. I was going, I wonder if so-and-so's doing trips. And I went, well, I guess not now.
Yeah.
But... Yeah, which is sad, but yeah.
And one of the things that I think about, you know, so if we, I don't know that we need to go through every single point in Peter's life or anything, but just things that are hitting us. But one of the things is one of the very first things for me, and that is, you know, Jesus strolling on the Sea of Galilee, and he sees Simon and Andrew, and they're fishing, casting nets, and he says, "Follow me. And I will make you fish for people," right? Or fishers of men, depending on which version. And they said, "Okay." All right. They drop their stuff and they start following him, right? You know, that's what the passage says. Mm-hmm. But you can imagine that, first of all, I'm sure it happened quickly. I'm not saying I can't fill in pieces of the gospel, but surely there was some consideration, right? It says immediately, but surely I just can't imagine, or I try to imagine what kind of presence would get me out of where I am and follow. Because that is like a major life choice, right? I just think I'm amazed by it every time I encounter it, you know?
Yeah. Well, yeah, because the thing I like about this book, and again, I think we could stop qualifying it, because I can think of several other books that make the same, similar points, you know? Mm-hmm. This book just brings it together all really, really well.
Yeah.
And it's not super long. It's easy to read. The points are made really clearly. So you will find this stuff in other places that are good, but this is really a great book to do it in. But the thing I like is the continual pointing out of this isn't the first time they heard of this guy. He was famous. He would have been preaching around. People were flocking to hear him. So very likely the fishermen, Peter and the guys, would have at least heard around the edges. And we know that Andrew was a disciple of John the Baptist, right? Isn't he one of the ones that went to Jesus and said, "Follow me"? And Jesus said, "Come and see." And he did. And then he went and got his brother Simon, who became Peter, and said, "You've got to see this guy. This is the Messiah."
This is the guy.
You. Yeah. Yep. This is the guy. And you always assume when you read these things, or I do, in different gospels, like, well, that's it. Now they're following him. But that doesn't mean they stayed with him. That means they were with him for a day or two. And then what? You know, I got to go fishing. I got an income. I have all these things going on. And so they go back. So he would have been maybe starting to be woven into their lives in that way. So I always think of that. And then I think, so when Jesus came along and said, "Follow me," because for one thing, wouldn't Peter have already rowed him out to listen, to speak to everybody when he was preaching from the boat, all that stuff. So when he did that, I think you're right. It's the presence. It's the having that person look in your eyes and you cannot resist. Yeah. It means something more than it sounds like in the book.
Right. And that is a good point too. It's not like they left and never came home. Because one of the things that is pointed out in this book as well is that Jesus was using Peter's house.
Yeah, he was
living
there.
And I love that. I don't think you watch The Chosen, but that's being displayed in The Chosen as well, that TV show.
I watched a few.
Yeah. So you can imagine. I mean, Jesus showing up at your house, you're hosting him at your house, and really that becomes home base for this group. And of course now people are coming to the house all the time, crowds are showing up at your door, all those kinds of things. And but you're right. I mean, he would have had to keep working, because where are they getting all their money and all that kind of stuff? Where are they getting all their food? All those things.
After a while, I think he didn't.
Yeah,
after a while,
I agree.
He was just following him.
Yeah.
At first though.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Then after that, they were living on donations and the women who followed the group and cooked and stuff. Well, I think of it, it's funny because I'm not watching The Chosen, but I do think of it when you said that. I suddenly went, oh my gosh, because does Binns make the point that maybe the apostles were married? Yeah, I can't remember.
I think he Unfortunately, mentions Peter's I'm reading. Wife.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because I'm also reading... there's another book that you chose for later that's quite a big book. So I'm reading a little of that every day, and so I'm starting to get them conflated. But I thought he mentioned at least Peter probably had a wife. She just doesn't get mentioned. Though I assumed maybe she was dead. But anyway, it doesn't matter. But I think of the mother-in-law at least is mentioned. And it's like, oh, how much food do I have to have ready? Oh, here's another gang of people. Super. think how flexible you'd have to be to just serve in that way. And then I think of Mary and Martha, and it starts to all kind of go together of everywhere Jesus went, would have been a big crowd of people. It would have been really disruptive. And Martha's not complaining about that, but when she complains about, like, can you tell Mary to help me? I don't have any help in the kitchen, and she's just sitting around listening to you. I mean, and that's okay, but who's going to make the unleavened bread?
Yeah.
Come on.
Right.
So it just made me think of how much his presence throws everything out of whack, so you have to really think about the focus you have on stuff. Is it going to be serving others? Is it going to be hospitality? Is it going to be not being the center of attention? Because that seems to be one of the things Peter, as a masterful fisherman who was, as I said, he had his own crew of people and everything. He was used to running things. And he would sublimate himself to Jesus. But those times when, and it makes me mad when priests will go, and then there's Peter. And I'm like, how many of us would have gone, oh, Jesus, come on, really? Because he was a good friend, too.
Yeah.
You know, you say the wrong thing, you get yourself into trouble, but it's, you know, you are who you are in a lot of ways.
You aren't meant to put aside your life's experiences. You know, you'd think you'd be chosen because of some of that. And if you if you think you know a thing, wouldn't you be remiss in not mentioning that? You know? So
please stop telling everybody you got to be crucified, man, or killed. Really, it is not cool.
That's right. Yeah. Oh, there's a point that Benz makes too, just about discipleship in general, that I liked. He says the gospel stresses that Jesus takes the initiative in discipleship.
Yes.
And that he invites men and women to come and follow.
Yeah.
In John's gospel, Jesus emphasizes that the discipleship is a divine choice. You did not choose me, but I chose you in John. Mm-hmm. So discipleship is not something that anyone can earn or that anyone deserves. It is God's gift. And by responding in faith, a person can accept God's call only in humility and gratitude. And then he goes on to make the point that even though Peter would eventually become a great leader, Peter learned that whatever leadership qualities he possessed were acquired through his faithful response to Jesus. And I think that is a nice pattern that we see him going through, Peter going through, is that realization that it's his faithful response to Jesus that is giving him the qualities that he needs to possess in order to move forward. And he finally gets there, right? At least I think he does.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Because that's really been my experience.
Yeah.
And I have so far to go because I'm never going to get there all the way, of course. But I do like when I can see a little progress. But it is that thing of you're going to continually be reminded, or I am, of, oh, yeah, okay, I got this really wrong. And I don't like to think about it, and I'm embarrassed of it, and I'm whatever. But you know what? I still got to get up and keep going.
Yeah.
And I can maybe do better next time.
Right.
Lean on God more, do better some other way.
And that's a great lesson that Peter gives us, I think, his whole life, if we look at it.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, this hits home for me, you know. Whatever leadership qualities he possessed were acquired through his faithful response.
Yeah.
That's great advice. And to see him just go through these things in his life, again, it's inspiring to us that fall. You know, it's really something that, you know, this is the guy that Jesus seems to be talking to in a lot of the Gospels. You know, he's talking to Peter directly. It's you that I need to step up, buddy, you know, and react correctly. And he's teaching Peter. He's teaching Peter the whole time. And hopefully that's what's happening to us. It's inspiring to me. To see that whole journey.
Mm-hmm. Because, yeah, a certain amount of the book is, of course, after Jesus has ascended and the Holy Spirit has come, and then the book of Acts, where we're told more of what happens with Peter, and then later Paul comes in, and Peter is not talked about as much. But one of the things I liked that this book points out is it says, The key to Acts is provided by the words of the risen Christ. You will be my witnesses in Jerusalem, in all Judea, in Samaria, and to the ends of the earth. This opening out of the gospel message to a continually wider audience forms the structure of the book, and Peter is shown to be the catalyst of each new stage of the church's expansion. The good news of salvation is offered first to the Jews in Jerusalem, and from there it spreads first to the Samaritans. Then the gospel is brought to the coastal region, to the inhabitants of Lydda, Sharon, and Joppa. The outreach to the Gentiles, the clearest expression of the church's universal mission, begins with Peter entering the home of Cornelius and the conversion of his household. This mission then continues with Paul's journeys throughout Asia Minor into Greece, and finally to the capital of the empire, the city of Rome. And I know that when I've studied Acts in a Bible study, they were talking about the concentric circles of, you know, every time the church is attacked or whatever happens, you know, everybody runs away and that spreads everything out. And I hadn't really connected it with Peter exactly in the way that Stephen Binns does. And I really liked that, is that he's still there as kind of holding the center together, is the way he puts it. And he's like, because the focus goes to Paul later, because Paul's out there doing the big stuff in the outlying areas, and that needs to be seen too. But it always, for big decisions, comes back to Peter.
Yeah.
All of them. But Peter is the usually the final word on stuff.
Right, right.
And that's so important for listening to, using your best judgment, listening to what you think God wants the whole time.
Yeah.
I mean, that's key.
It is key. You know, and that whole, I guess, the circumcision discussion in the book of Acts, where the question before the church was, do you need to be circumcised to be Christian?
Right.
Was one of the very first things. And I point that out to new people all the time, especially Protestants. Who are considering the church. And I say, you want to know how the church works? Well, it's right here in the book of Acts. Here it is. Here's them arguing about this thing. And they basically call a council. And Peter made the decision. So it's just right there. And we're still operating pretty much the same way.
Well, yeah. And even before, is circumcision before the thing about Cornelius?
Because go ahead.
When Cornelius's household is converted, Peter has been at prayer on a rooftop, and he had a vision three times of all this food being offered, and him going, oh, no, I'd never eat anything unclean, and the voice going, no, it's everything's fine. Do not worry about it.
Yeah.
It's all good.
So don't call unclean what,
I have made and clean. And then, but then he gets the knock at the door going, hey, we really need to talk to you over here at Cornelius's household. He's had a vision of something different.
Yeah.
And he goes over and talks to him and goes, oh my gosh, this is the Holy Spirit. He's working with these people. Okay. Let's start baptizing. Let's get everything going. And everybody comes up to him later and goes, what are you doing? These are Gentiles. And so again, Peter is used to open it up, and he has to defend it and say, this is what God wants.
Yeah.
He told us this.
Right, right.
Yeah. So that's his first personal example of that. Yep. And then comes the circumcision and the pushback on eating things, eating foods that are might be considered unclean. And each time he's got to fall back on what does his experience and everything tell him as part of the conversation that's being had with Paul or whoever.
Yeah, yeah. Right. You know? And with input. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's exactly what you mean. You know, with Paul, I mean, he's not doing it on an island. He's asking for input and stuff. And that's what our popes do.
Because the James who was in charge of Jerusalem at the time, he was like, oh no, this isn't happening, forget about it. And Peter's like, I think it's good. Okay, well, we'll send a letter to everybody then.
And you know, Peter's been through like pretty much his whole life by that time, or all these events that we're talking about. And there's another point that Ben's made that I loved. He said that experience shows that those who are forgiven the most are able to love the most. And there's something to that, you know. So Peter was able to do his thing because he had been through that and forgiven, and it made him more apt to forgive. which was another point of contention between Peter and Paul, I think, is that, you know, Peter was more apt to be open, I think, and Paul wanted to be a little more rigid, I would say.
In what way?
Isn't that talked about in the book where he was talking about, it was basically the whole idea of, because the circumcision question was really about Gentiles or non-Jewish people coming into the church. And they were talking about Peter going out, and so there was a difference between who Peter was talking to and who Paul was talking to.
I don't know, because I don't remember this, but what I do remember is that Paul was all over anybody who wanted to insist people be circumcised.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he was like, absolutely not. How dare you make them do that? And so I was thinking maybe that was some of the things where, because that's the thing where they were still considered among, even internally, like, well, we're still Jewish.
Mm-hmm.
So they have to be circumscribed? No, what am I saying?
Circumcised.
Circumcised. Thank you. Right. Yep. I was like, I know I have close to the word. Uh-huh. Anyway.
Yeah.
I want to say circumscribed and it doesn't matter. Circumcised. Anyway, but the thing is I thought it was the elders of the church because of this misunderstanding that were going, absolutely not. And Peter is the one who went, no, I think it's okay.
Uh-huh.
But Paul is always the one, I think, who's going, no, they don't have to eat the food that we, you know, they can eat whatever they want, except stuff that's been sacrificed to idols. And that's, everybody agrees on that. They don't have to be follow any of the Jewish rules. And he's always fighting with everybody about it. He was a Jew who was persecuting Christians. He was Roman by citizenship, and that only gets brought up when he thinks it's going to help him because he's been arrested by all the Jewish people for not being Jewish enough.
Mm-hmm.
And he's going to be stoned to death. And so the Romans show up and go, well, this looks like an internal affair. You can take your guy back. And he's like, I'm also Roman. And they're like, what? Well, get that guy over here then.
Mm-hmm.
So that was really secondary.
Okay.
That was just because of his, you know, his parents. And so, no, he was a disciple of Gamaliel. Is that the name of the Pharisee who, the first time around, when everybody was saying, we really need to shut this down. Jesus is dead and everything. And he's like, no, hold on. We've had this kind of thing before. Just let it go. If it's nothing, it'll fall apart. If it isn't, it's probably from God. Well, that was the rabbi who was teaching Saul at the time. But the great thing about Paul is he was, of course, just as Peter in his personality and his training and his traveling hand in hand or arm in arm or whatever with Jesus for 3 years, trained him to the point of understanding how to listen for God, how to look deeper, all that kind of thing, and how to work within these groups and hold them together a little bit. Paul, who originally was Saul, because he had such a deep steeping in training to be a Jewish rabbi, he was the perfect person to send out to the Gentiles, surprisingly, because he, they get and go, what's imprisoned? And so a lot of times, especially certain, I don't know which Protestant groups, but you'll find Protestants who think, or maybe even secular people who go, Paul's the one who made Christianity into a different religion than Judaism. Well, that's not true, but he was one of the two main people, authorities who were looked to, because he's the one who said, no, the unclean food doesn't matter because this is about Jesus. But what gets forgotten a lot of the time, because it's not played up a lot, is that after his conversion on the road to Damascus and staying a little while with, you know, the people there and everything, he goes into the desert for, is it 3 years? And just lives by himself. And those are the times that he says, you know, when he comes back and he's going to Peter and everything and getting approval. He's going to Peter for approval to go see the Gentiles. But he's saying, I'm also an apostle. I saw Jesus. He told me.
Right.
And you'll see in different letters, he'll go, Jesus told me this. And so those two together, that's why you have the feast of Peter and Paul. in sometime during the summer, June or July, I think.
Yeah.
I could be wrong.
So I definitely had that backwards. Yeah. So I found the place in the book too. So Paul was entrusted with evangelizing the uncircumcised.
Yeah.
And Peter, it was entrusted to the circumcised or the Jews, right? So yeah. Peter was actually evangelizing Jewish people and Paul was evangelizing Gentiles.
Right.
Yep, exactly.
And of course, there was a certain amount of cross-pollination no matter where they went because they were going to run into both. Mm-hmm. But I think Peter was traditionally living amongst Jewish populations like in Rome or wherever. And of course, Paul was out there and the first place he'd go was to the synagogues because that's what you did. Then when they'd kick him out, usually, then he'd go, okay, that's fine. Who else? How about down mm-hmm. here by the river? Let's go talk to people. He didn't care.
Right.
But both of them had that enlightenment from God in different ways that you can't just kick people out because they're not following the Jewish rules. That's mm-hmm. done.
Right. And it says here, Paul accused Peter of hypocrisy when he withdrew from table fellowship with Gentiles.
Yeah.
He had regularly eaten with Gentiles in Antioch, but only when Jewish Christians sent by James came from Jerusalem did he withdraw. And this is what I was thinking of when I first brought up the subject. Mm. So there's some stuff in Galatians. But then it was as if Peter wasn't doing that because he was going to offend somebody else. And I think that he saw that in order to hold all this together, I've got to do it this certain way. And Paul was not appreciative of that.
I just think Paul was a firebrand. Yeah. I think Paul was out there going, are you kidding me? Come on.
Yeah.
And Peter's like, okay, just calm down. I'm dealing with all stuff. I got James in Jerusalem right here. I got a lot of balls in the air, man.
That's right. Yeah. Let me do my thing. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. So then, of course, it all ended up right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Because since it would all come back and everybody kind of talk it over, eventually, though, it would come down to what does Peter say?
Right, yeah.
And they never would put it that way in Acts, but then they go, and then Peter said, yeah, I think this way. And they go, okay, well, so now we're sending a letter to all the churches to say this is how it's going to be.
Yeah.
And it's underplayed to us, but at the time that the book of Acts was written, it would have been very prominent.
Yeah, right. Yeah, there's a sentence here. In the tug of war between principle and pragmatism, Peter seems to have taken a middle way. Mm-hmm. He tried to hold both sides at once. Essentially, he agreed with Paul that the covenant markers were not essential practice for believers. But for the sake of peace and the unity of the church, Peter stepped back from table fellowship so as not to create problems for the Jewish Christians and their relationship with the church in Jerusalem. It says Peter's concern was for the unity of the church. So as the leader there, I mean, that's going to be his biggest concern is how to keep this together. Yeah.
Yeah, and it's, you know, the people I live with in my household, if they listen to this, they're going to laugh because I'm reading Team of Rivals right now.
Oh, yeah.
Which is the most.
Doris Kearns Goodwin, yeah.
Yeah, have you read it?
I haven't read that one. I read one called The Bully Pulpit, which was about Roosevelt and Taft.
Yeah.
But yeah, that book is on my list. I would like to read that one. But anyway, please go ahead. Yeah, I'm familiar with it, but I haven't read it.
Yeah, it's amazing. There's a, I can put a link, a blog that you pay a subscription fee every year to get the conversation that's going on. But the guy basically picks a huge book, like he started with War and Peace and did that. I'd like a chapter a week. Over a year, and everybody would talk about it. And now he's kind of worked through a few huge books like that. So he's doing a list of big books, so like Dune and things like that. And he's doing Team of Rivals, and I was like, oh man, I don't know. But Tom had it on his bedstand. It was a Christmas gift, and I went, well, all right. And I read the first chapter, and I was like, I can barely make myself stop with what's going to be discussed each week. It's so good. But one of the things is that Abraham Lincoln kind of was really good at doing that thing that we're talking about Peter doing, which is that you have to balance all these rival factions within one group, in his case, the Republican Party. And it's not because they don't all have one overarching goal, which is anti-slavery, but it's because there's a lot of stuff that everybody else cares about maybe more.
Mm.
This group cares about tariffs. This group cares about immigration. Does this sound familiar? And so he's having to say, I understand what everybody's worried about. And it's not that he's lying. He's very consistent. But he lets everybody know that they've been heard and he can feel what they're feeling. And that they can trust him. And I can really see Peter having to develop this sense of how to walk this way and, you know, essentially be a pope.
Right.
How do you have the basic rules that are fair to everyone? And you say, but you know what? This isn't required. If you don't want to eat these foods, you don't have to. But you can't make these people not eat them.
Mm.
You know?
Yep. Yep.
You could go ahead and get circumscribed if you want. Or, I cannot.
I love it.
Okay. I don't know what my brain's doing, but it's doing that thing. Anyway.
Yeah.
The other people don't. Nobody has to.
Mm-hmm.
You want to do it? Go right ahead.
Right. Right. Yep.
And I mean, look now. In America, that's usually the only way it goes. That's just a custom.
It's just a stunning thing to look at this and... It's like we're having the same arguments today. It's over a different thing, but it's, you got the Pope over there with the concerns of trying to hold it together and everybody yelling at him from the sides, you know.
Yeah.
Saying you're not doing it right.
The real conservative, the real progressive, the, you know, where do you hold it in the middle? And he's got the whole tradition and teachings of the church going on, but there's a lot of wiggle room because there's a lot of respect paid to the community and how important the community is in all these different places. Here are the non-negotiables, but here are all the things that you can, you know, you can go this way or that way with it. That's okay.
Right. Yeah.
You can have banana pudding.
Did you happen to
see
that, interview with Pope Francis by, ABC? So a week or two ago.
Yeah.
And all this stuff that we've been arguing about and that Pope's been accused of and all this kind of stuff. And she asks him about, you know, homosexual unions and all this other stuff. And she basically said, hey, you've allowed the blessing of homosexual unions. And he said, no, I haven't. Right. He said, I didn't do that. I agreed with the blessing of individuals because everybody's blessed, right? We're everybody, you know. He says, but no, I can't bless a homosexual union. I can't do that. You know, God has spoken, right? He said something like that. And but it should have embarrassed the person asking the question, because it's the news that is telling us that that he said certain things.
Well, and this goes down also to papal style. Different popes would say it more clearly or less clearly, and he should have clarified that a little earlier. But when it came down to it, he's like, oh, no, 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 no. Well, it's like the thing, too, where she tried this sympathy. I just think of a little girl in America growing up Catholic, thinking she'd like to be a deacon someday. Is it possible that she could ever be, you know, one of the priests, or, you know, not the priesthood, but, you know, all that. And he's like, and I just love the answer. No.
No.
This has been addressed before. He didn't say that, but I was like, they talked about this a lot. But it's that idea of putting your expectations onto what's right onto something else that other people don't agree with you on. And he has been very conciliatory, I think, in a lot of ways that are easy to misunderstand in our news bite society. And, but when it comes down to it, because I think his style is just more, I hate to say casual, but kind of like, I would like everybody to have a conversation.
Yeah.
Let's just talk about it. And surely we'll all realize that, you know, this can't possibly be. And what happens is everybody goes, great, we are going to fight to the death over it. And he finally has to come in and go, no, 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 yes, yes, no, no, no.
Right.
And
then
everybody acts surprised.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it goes so right what you're Peter. Saying. You know, there's things that are not changeable, and there are things that are wiggly, you know?
Yeah.
And, yeah, exactly. Yeah. Because the idea that a person can come forward and you would refuse to bless them is really, when you think about it, that's pretty horrible. And I'm not talking about unions. I'm talking about a person, you know?
Well, you know? And this comes back to the idea of, I know this likes to get twisted around because it doesn't give people everything they want to get sometimes, but it's everybody's always welcome in the Catholic Church.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody. We want all of them. Meaning anybody who wants to come in, when I say them.
Yeah.
But it's the idea that everybody's got stuff in their lives that they have to deal with. And some of it is more serious than others. Some of it they've got to grapple with in a way, because we are all sinners. We all have to go to confession. And for some people, the things that they're confessing means that they're not going to get the same privileges as other people because they have disqualified themselves based on what the church teaches and believes. And if they're honest about coming to grips with what the church teaches and why, then they can make a good decision about, do I think this is correct and want to follow this logical reasoning and I better go along with it or I won't. It's them letting themselves in or out. We're ready for anybody.
Yeah, that's well put. Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're right. You're exactly right. Said perfectly.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah. So yeah, so we're closing in. With. We're closing in on an hour here. Yeah, but I do love this book, but I do want to talk a little bit about the burial of Peter in the Vatican Hill.
Mm-hmm.
I just find that a fascinating story. And that Constantine in the 300s, when he converted to Christianity and then built the basilica, mm-hmm. and he built it on that spot, you know, that Peter was buried. And then that stood for a long time. And then what in the, was it 14, 1500s? I think it took 120 years to build the one that's there now.
Yes.
And they built it on top of the remains of the other one. Mm-hmm. And still just right over where Peter was buried. And the whole story about in the 1940s, they were like, I wonder if Peter is really down there. And somebody got permission to start digging under the building, and they did so, and they found amazing things down there. That was, it was just a wonderful story. There's a couple of books. I've read them both. The Fisherman's Tomb by John O'Neill. And The mm-hmm. Bones of St. Peter by John Evangelist Walsh.
That's the one I've read.
Yeah, they're good stories.
And I think the other one's fairly new, so I just haven't come across it. Yeah, I think
The Fisherman's Tomb is the new one.
Yeah, and that one I just happened to be in our church library, which is really wonderfully stocked. And somebody went, have you ever read this book? Huh?
Yeah.
So I read the Walsh book, and it was astounding. Cool. I had no idea. It was a real mystery story. You know?
Yeah, yeah. And they were trying to put that together, and yeah. Imagine their excitement, you know. So you got these archaeologists down there, and they're digging, and the first thing, I think they were digging for something, and somebody found one of the necropolises, I think you call them. It's like an above-ground grave.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was like, oh, this is interesting. And then they realized, well, there's a whole... Yeah, because Constantine, when he said, I'm going to build this thing here and all this stuff, we're going to have to cover all these with dirt in order to make this flat, you know. And I can imagine that the families that owned those things were not thrilled. but that's what he did. He said, all right, we're going to do this. And then it's just been buried that way. And it's so well preserved. And yeah, I got to go down there. That was one of the things I did when I was in Rome.
That's is we so went neat. On the Scavi tour. I'd love to go.
Yeah. So you end up at the end of the tour. There's a guide who you can see Peter's bones at the box. There's a box, but it's not, you can't see it easily. They shine a light kind of through this crack that you can look through.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it's pretty humbling just to be standing that close to the tomb of Peter. It's absolutely amazing down there too, because they've got it excavated where you're walking down little streets.
And you can
look in the windows, and people that had these graves had mosaics on the floors. I mean, it was like, you know, there'd be three or four coffins in a corner, and then the rest of it is just really decorated nice. And, it was really, really neat. It was really an incredible experience. When they were digging down there and they found graffiti, you know, that said, "Peter is here." And, so, you know, that was kind of leading them down this road. I think Peter might be here. And there's really strong evidence that what they did find was Peter. So,
And the thing I love about the whole story is the graffiti.
Hmm.
The people mark Peter's here.
Yeah.
Or, you know, writing prayers on the wall.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I love to think of them when he was buried and it was hidden, sneaking in there, you know, maybe with somebody going, "Well, let's go pray by Peter's tomb. You know, he's our friend."
Yeah.
He's our papa.
Mm-hmm.
And it's that sense of family and community that you never lose. That's the reason, you know, you feel like, "Oh, I'm near the bones of the first pope."
Mm.
It's not, I mean, yes, you go stand near George Washington's tomb. It's also amazing, I'm sure. Yep, but it's not the same feeling.
Yeah.
I would think.
Right. No, this I don't because, think so either. Yeah.
Yeah, because Peter's still alive and you can ask him to pray for you and he will.
Absolutely. Yeah. No matter where you're at.
Well, that's it.
That is something, and it's something that we Catholics do a lot, don't we? I mean, with our relics and our, you know, various things, we like to build churches on top of where places are, where things happened. Seems to be, I don't know if it's a uniquely Christian thing, but one of the tours I remember taken by this person, Elizabeth Lev.
Oh, yeah.
She was fantastic. She was really great. But you know, she was saying that's kind of a hallmark of Christian stuff. We like to build our stuff where people were buried, you know? We like to do that. You know, we like to build a church where Peter's house was, you know, that kind of stuff. And, So anyway, I did love it.
Yeah. It sounds wonderful. I'd love it.
It was really wonderful, but you're absolutely right that, you know, we can pray to Peter anytime and ask for his intercession. And, you know, especially in his inspiring life, you know, with the stumbles he made and everything. And, you know, it's somebody that I certainly identify with, and I do hold him in high esteem.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Saint Peter, pray for us.
Yeah. Oh, Saint Peter, pray for us. We need it for our church and for our country.
Yeah, absolutely.
And for us.
And for us.
People.
Definitely. Yeah. Definitely. You bet. Yeah. Well, is there anything else you'd like to say about this book?
No, because there's so many things. This is just a really great book.
Yeah. And it's not terribly long either. Just for the folks out.
No.
A couple hundred pages.
Each chapter does end in some questions, which I never care about questions like that, but they might make people think about one deeply. So they might like that.
Well,
so
it might be something you'd use if you had a little group.
Yeah, if you have a group of people.
Mm-hmm.
Something I wanted to say, I found the name of that book I was thinking about.
Great.
It's called The 12,
The
Lives of the Apostles After Calvary. And it's by C. Bernard Ruffin, Ruffin. And it was first published, I think, in like something like 1984, 1987. And then published again in 1998.
Okay.
But it's, every time I've looked up the, you know, whatever apostle to see if some question has been solved differently lately in modern times, it's very solid.
Very good.
And so it's a chapter on each apostle. What did they do? What happened with their lives? What do we know about them? Where did they wind up? You know, most of all of them, but the beloved disciple John were martyred.
Mm-hmm.
So, all those stories are told, and there's some great stuff in there. Like, I'm particularly fond of Thomas, the doubting apostle, and he wound up going somewhere right after Jesus ascended and Pentecost happened. That was because the leader of a country wrote Jesus a letter and went, I've heard they've treated you horribly. You come here. We'd love to have you. You know, and Jesus wrote back and went, I'm going to send some people. Uh-huh. I'm busy, but thank you. Uh-huh. And so you just go, I didn't know that happened. That's amazing. You know, and this guy qualifies everything and puts sources and all that kind of stuff. And he'll say, well, this might not have happened, but they do have a copy of this letter here still in this place. And so it's also good for the kinds of things that you find in this book about St. Peter in terms of just looking at their lives, what they were led to do, and kind of making you reflect more on your own life and what you're being asked to do.
Mm-hmm.
So, anyway.
Yes, I agree. That's great.
Yeah.
Yeah. Inspiring people.
I'm glad you picked it.
Well, thank you. That was fun. That was fun.
It was.
All right. So, what do we got next? Ah, movie.
Let's see.
The Bridge on the River Kwai.
Oh, and I've never seen that movie.
Oh, okay. Very good.
I have seen clips. Uh-huh. I've heard that whistled song. Is that it?
Yeah.
I know the essence of it, but I'm excited to see it.
Well, good. I'm glad you are. I hope you enjoy it. There'll be plenty to talk about, even if you're like, oh, I hate that thing.
I cannot imagine hating that thing. Yeah. William Holden, Alec Guinness.
Right, right.
World War II.
Yep.
Come on.
All of this stuff. All of this stuff. You bet. Well, good. I'm looking forward to talking about that.
Yeah, me too.
Okay. All right. Well, thanks for listening, everybody.
Yeah. We'll talk to you soon.
All right. See you in a couple weeks.
Yeah.
Okay. Bye. Bye-bye.